Line.
Welcome back, Afropolitans. It is a Monday evening, and we talk all things political and economical in this show. Now, we now know that the president is about to unleash his economic recovery blueprint later on this week. And we now know, unfortunately, that indeed, as some of us were hoping it wouldn't happen, it actually has transpired that a lot of people have lost their jobs in the past 6 months. The Status A report that we saw telling us exactly where the jobs have been lost, the 2.2 million, and the fact that it's going to get worse was sobering for a lot of us. But here we are, and we now need to start talking the way forward. And of course, as happens in the age of social media, somebody leaked the report last week, didn't they? And when I looked at it, I was like, 48 interesting pages. I don't know if this is the right thing. I don't know if this is the thing that we're waiting for. But somebody who understands these things much better than we do here on radio is, of course, the executive director of the Center for Development Enterprise, Anne Bernstein, who joins us now on the line. Good evening, Anne.
Good evening, Kaya. Thanks for the chance to talk to you tonight.
Let's just go back a couple of weeks ago. Status A releases the data, and then they tell us just the picture of what has happened in the past 6 months. As the Center for Development and Enterprise, what did you guys see when you read that report? Was it within what you had thought would happen, and do you see any way out?
Look, we released a big report on the job crisis in late January this year. It seems a long time ago. And this report was called 10.3 million and rising. 10 million and rising unemployed in South Africa. And to that number, you now need to add the 2.2 million, more or less, that have lost their jobs at the height of lockdown. I think it's really important to sort of think about, you know, what happens the next 3 months, the third quarter of the year, and how many people will get those jobs back. So that was at the worst time of the lockdown. But either way, the job situation in South Africa is absolutely catastrophic. And it is probably the deepest in the world, even before COVID. And this, I think the country needs to take this issue much, much more seriously than we do. We sort of talk about projects and doing this and doing that, but that we never really deal with the actual issues as to why South Africa has such a high unemployment rate.
Let us go back to those issues. And I mean, obviously the CDE would have done a lot of deep diving into trying to figure out the root causes of this. I mean, at the end of the day, if somebody had to say, just tell me briefly what exactly is the root cause of South Africa's unemployment crisis, and more importantly, why aren't we doing anything about it, what would you say?
I'd say the following. Our history as a country, apartheid, and the failure over 60 years to create a skilled workforce is one of the big root causes. The sort of destruction of the rural economy, the black rural economy, is another cause. So we have, compared to other developing countries, we have far fewer people employed in the rural areas doing agriculture than in other countries. But that's our history. If you look at today, there are two big causes of why we are doing so badly. The first is that we have had very sluggish growth since about 2007, 2008. And you can't put jobs in one corner and growth in another. You have to understand the relationship between fast growth and more jobs. So growth is absolutely fundamental to getting more jobs. But the second part, which we don't talk about nearly enough, is that we don't just need faster growth, we need more labor-intensive growth. So South Africa has chosen, really, to support capital-intensive activity that require fewer and fewer workers and more skilled workers. And we're saying we need to have jobs and an economy that provides jobs for the workforce we have today, which is a mainly unskilled one. It's not what I want, and the country should have done much better at skilling people up, even under democracy. We've not done well. But the reality is this is where we are. And unless we make our economy much more labor-intensive, we're just never going to provide or create the kinds of numbers of jobs that we need. You know, and when you're talking about millions and millions of people, little projects are not really significant. You know, helps a few people, but in terms of really making a difference on this issue and changing the politics on this issue, we have to be talking of scale.
You know, and when you talk about this, I actually used this example with one of the leaders in one of the big banks a few weeks ago, where this bank has now said, look, we no longer need as many branches as you used to, so we're closing down the branches. And the question then, I was like, well, does capitalism or do, you know, big business leaders have a responsibility of saying, look, even though we could do without that branch, since the consequences of us closing it down are that 10 more people are going to be unemployed in a country, as you said, that is a 10 million unemployment crisis already, we could perhaps defer or delay our adoption of the type of technologies that would then enable this person to keep their job as a teller. And the response was, well, at the end of the day, we all have a part to play in it, because if I then turn around and say, oh no, but I still don't want to go to a branch, I want to transact from the convenience of my phone, then it's really just this cycle we get ourselves entrapped in, because I want convenience, but the consequence of that convenience is that the person who used to service me now no longer can be employed, and the bank has to adapt and say, well, this is where the issues are. How do we then react with that particular paradigm being the reality of where we are?
A very good question. I'll give you a fact first, which is when the banks introduced ATMs all over the world and in South Africa, many people thought this would lead to a reduction in jobs. In fact, this new technology has led to more efficiency and more jobs. So we have to be very careful. I am not saying that we must hold back from new technology. I think that would be the wrong approach. We need a more productive economy, and you know, capital then gets diverted to more productive uses, and we need to go with the technological flow. We can't hold it back, and you don't know what the consequences are from holding it back. And it might be you get less jobs, in fact, because the bank is less competitive or efficient. So that is not what we're saying. What we're saying is, in a sense, if you like, the sort of top end of our economy, the sort of globally competitive top end, which needs skilled people and technology, that must proceed. We shouldn't stop that. But we need to do two other things. We need to do what almost every other developing country has done that has not discovered oil. They have gone for low-skill manufacturing, not because that's the end point of development, but because that's the first step. And so the people making my T-shirt get into the modern economy, they learn skills, they learn know-how, and they move up. They can one day make a men's shirt, which is much more sophisticated, or get to manage people making those things. But South Africa says, no, we won't have those kinds of activities. And I think we see where we've ended up. So we're saying we've got to open space in our economy to get into providing, sort of producing low-skill products that could get into global supply chains, which have been disrupted now by COVID, and that gives us an opportunity. And let's see how big that can go. So that's the one thing we're arguing for. The second thing we're saying is it's really criminal that we still have such a terrible education system for so many people who just don't get the kind of education I got in a public school. This is outrageous. And we need to improve our public schooling so that people get a reasonable education. And then we've also got to look at technical and vocational education. It's very expensive in South Africa for the taxpayer, for the government, and the results are very bad. So there are lots of things we could be doing, both short-term, medium-term, and longer-term, to improve South Africa's situation. But we have to change some aspects of the labor market to encourage employers and investors to hire unskilled workers.
And I was speaking to a group of Forum of Engineers last week, and one of the things that we were discussing is, you know, just the imbalance in the bargaining power between the incumbents of the labor market and the outsiders. And this was on the back of the fact that last week there was a march, and, you know, the civil servants who got bargaining power in their capacity as people who are sitting around the table at NEDLAC, for example. So they are bargaining for a higher wage. And our issue there was that there are so many people who actually do not even have anything in the form of income, and it doesn't look like there is a proper structure where we can ventilate on those issues and say, yes, we're hearing what the currently employed are saying, these are their demands, but in order for us to ensure that one additional person may be absorbed within the system, let's think this way, let's, you know, negotiate this way. What are we going to do about the fact that far too many people, the 10 million you refer to, quite simply don't have a seat in any of these conversations?
Well, couldn't agree more with you. I think that is the big divide in South Africa. When you come down to the basics, it's between people who've got a job and people who don't have a job. That is our biggest cause in many ways of inequality and lack of hope for the future. We're proposing, so I'll give you one example. The collective bargaining system in the country doesn't just allow for workers in a factory or in a union or in a sector to negotiate through their union with the employers. I'm in favor of that. What they also allow for is that the deal they make, the guys around the table, they can then extend that deal to people who are not around that table, to smaller firms, to rural firms, to new firms, to all sorts of people, and we're saying that is one of the things holding things back. So you can, you know, so we're not saying that we should undermine the rights that unionized workers have struggled for so long to achieve and that they should have those bargaining rights. But why should it be extended to other firms who are not sitting around that table? Because that raises the barrier for new workers to get into the labor market.
Now, Anne, the president will give us something, we hope, something on Thursday. What do you expect to see from the president's blueprint?
Well, I've been reading the draft that's floating around, and look, let me put it this way. The most important things for me are the following. He has to communicate how desperately bad the situation for South Africa is. We have a fiscal crisis, a growth, lack of growth crisis. We have an unemployment crisis. We're now starting to see a social welfare and instability crisis. And this was all terrible before COVID, and COVID has made it much worse. Hard to know exactly how bad, but it's worse. We know that. He's got to communicate that to everyone, and then he's got to say, we have to do things differently. And we have a number of points we would make, but this is all made much harder. So you look at all the laundry lists from NEDLAC, from all the documents that are floating around, and I suspect his document is going to be very similar to the NEDLAC so-called social partners document. The key issue is South Africa, we don't have an effective state. It's not an ideological issue. It's the state has been broken, it's corrupt, it's weak. It doesn't mean there's nothing that works. It just means that we can't assume, like in the 20 years ago, you could say, well, the state's changing, but it has some capacity. If you think of local government, provincial government, and many national departments, with one or two exceptions, they're unbelievably weak and corrupt. So who will implement our reforms is a big question. So that you then have to say, well, we do have capacity in the private sector and markets. And maybe we must make the most of that. Not that they're perfect, but we have capacity to do all sorts of things there. And I would be looking to how you free up markets and business to in competitive ways to do as much as possible. So I think attitudes to the private sector, we don't want the state to discipline capital. We want it to enable businesses of small, medium, large, foreign, local. That's what I would be looking for. It's a key issue because I don't know how else we get things done. And I'm looking also for this is going to be done differently. So we've talked about infrastructure for decades now, but it doesn't happen well. When it's happened, we've wasted a lot of money. Think of Madupi or train coaches that are the wrong size. So infrastructure is not a simple silver bullet. What kind of infrastructure, where are we going to do it, and what will be really, really different that we can get significant private sector investment and then monitor that carefully, that we get value for money.
And regardless of what form and structure the president's final blueprint looks like, at the heart of it is going to be the question of funding. And for a state that has clearly depleted its reserves, that has nothing left, that has a 300 billion rand, under collection being anticipated by SARS, where would the money come from to implement any of the elements of the economic blueprint?
Well, the only place we can get funding is we have to restore South Africa's credibility in the eyes of investors, domestic and foreign. So we have to show as a country that we're serious about change, that the government is serious about taking control of its fiscal, of spending more than it receives in revenue, and that it's spending the money effectively. So I think putting money into SAA is a very bad decision. Putting money into the NPA to make sure we can start really turning the tide on corruption and make all the crooks scared, public and private sector, that would be a good investment. So but the key, the answer to your question is South Africa always needs foreign investors when we reach about 3% growth per annum, but now we need them even more than ever. And you've got to give them a sense of credibility. This is a reform story that will actually deliver, not the Jobs Summit Mark II, where nothing was really delivered after, 2018 Jobs Summit, lots and lots of promises, nothing really happened. So it's credibility. He's got to take some big steps that will show he's determined and serious, and that he's really thought through the implementation challenge. Well, it is a big challenge because the state is so weak. How is he going to get things done? And that has to be looking towards the private sector.
Yeah, I think that partnership is probably our best chance of getting things moving, because in the absence of that, the state needs to have a stronger credit profile in order to borrow from international markets. That on its own is not going to materialize overnight. We know the long path towards recovery or restoring just investment grade status is probably our biggest challenge. It will not happen overnight. So there's going to be a lot of challenges, and we're going to see, we're going to have to wait and see what the president unleashes when he unveils his national blueprint for the economic recovery, and then take it from there. And Bunstein, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Happy to come back when we have a recovery strategy.
We'll definitely bring you back. So Afropolitans, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be speaking to Sifiso Skenja now.